Good evening and welcome. This evening brings the first of an annual series of lectures, the BP lectures, so called because British Petroleum has endowed a chair here under the title of the BP LSE Centennial Visiting Professorship. One of the functions of the BP professor, and the one this evening, is to present a couple of public lectures. This chair is not preserved just for economists, more the pity, but it is also can cover, and will in future years, cover international trade, government, politics, finance, and business policy. This visiting chair will allow both those of us at LSE and also BP to have access to scholars involved in important practical policy issues whom otherwise we might have missed. In the first of our 2 years of the BP chair, this year and next, we are taking the opportunity to attract back to this country, if only for a limited time, leading British economists who have, alas, left us, if only for some considerable time, for the USA. Indeed, unfortunately, the list of British academics working in North America includes many of the brightest and best of our scholars in recent decades. We are extremely grateful to BP for funding this centennial visiting chair. This is the most generous, but not the only example of BP's support for LSE. They have contributed to our company loan scheme and to our library and the Lionel Robbins Loan Fund, among others. One of the purposes of this chair is to enhance cooperation between LSE and BP. Anything, indeed, that I can do in return to advise, say, on the future price of oil or company dividend policy, they have but to call on me. As I mentioned earlier, our BP professor this year, Professor John Williamson, left this country some 15 years ago for North America after a sparkling career, starting as an undergraduate here at LSE in the great years of 1955 and 1958, when the academic faculty almost matched up in standard to the present academic faculty. Subsequently, he worked as an academic economist at Warwick and York, together with putting a spell in at the Treasury. During those earlier years, he established a position as this country's leading expert in the international monetary field, where he became perhaps best known for inventing that splendid device, the crawling peg, which alas never got actually put into practice, I don't think. He may tell me better. He was then seduced away from us by the various charms of the American continent, north and south. His wife is a Brazilian economist, and he has held a chair at the Catholic University in Rio. But his main home for the last decade has been the Institute of International Economics in Washington, run by Fred Bergston. He has, of course, continued with his work on international monetary issues, providing blueprints for international coordination, which unfortunately our political readers do not seem to be able to read. But given his Brazilian connections, he naturally became involved with the problems of LDC debt and Latin American adjustment. Some of the lessons and experience gained in that adjustment process may well be applicable to the painful transition of the Eastern European countries as they move from a plan to a market economy. Accordingly, John has become one of the band of Western economists, perhaps a sequence of economists is the proper group noun, who have become closely involved in assessing and trying to assist and participate in that transitional process. Events in this field move so fast that it is hard to keep up with them. John has already been forced to rename his forthcoming conference, which he had earlier called the Economic Consequences of the Potential Collapse of the Soviet Union, and had to remove the word potential. Tonight he will be giving us an up-to-date snapshot of where those economies are now, and just as important, how they and we have come to this point. John.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, for those kind words. I would correct you that the crawling peg has been used by a number of countries from time to time. What it has never been done is adopted systemically as a part of an organized international monetary system. And, of course, when I first conceived of it, that was the role for which I had envisaged it. So, in that sense, you are quite right. I was asking Charles before the session started whether the remark of Russian Vice President Rutskoy, who is not one of the radicals in Russia, whether his remark about the Russian economic team, and I suppose their foreign advisers, as young men in pink pants, had been reported in this country, and he told me no. Well, I want to make one remark about when I was about the same age as the Russian economic team and I was in the British Treasury. And it happens that one of my duties at that time was to pass judgment on the corporate ambition of British Petroleum to become a power in the Western Hemisphere. Up until that time, BP had been essentially an Eastern Hemisphere company. But then they had discovered an oil field in Alaska. My recollection is that they also had found an American oil company, Sohio, that would like to be taken over by them and would thus provide an outlet for their anticipated Alaska production. And all they needed was to borrow £1 billion or so in the offshore market in order to put this plan to fruition. Now, I can't remember whether the Treasury at that time had to give permission because we were then the largest shareholder in BP, or because we still had exchange controls. But I do remember very clearly that Treasury sanction was needed and that a committee was duly set up in order to decide whether such sanction should be given. And since I was the only international economist around, or at least the only one who took an interest in policy questions, I was naturally put on the committee. It wasn't a difficult decision, but at least I think it was a sensible one, as I'm sure the sponsors of these lectures will agree. Now, the point is that if BP was to hatch an equally bold plan today, there is no chance whatsoever that my successor in the Treasury would be involved in deciding whether or not that plan came to fruition. The public sector holding in BP has been sold off, and exchange control has been abolished, so on neither account would the Treasury be involved today. Those are, of course, but two minor developments in what is a conspicuous, a dramatic global trend of the past 20 years. And the trend whose most dramatic manifestation is the attempt to make the transition to a market economy that I'm going to be discussing in these two lectures. This attempt at transition is without question one of the two great economic issues of the day. I imagine it's an issue which economic historians, a century hence, or a millennium hence, if there is still economic history at that time, are going to pore over with the same sort of attention that they've been devoting to the origins of the Industrial Revolution for the past century or more. And now I'm, as Charles said, one of those economists who's been fortunate enough to be at least marginally involved in this great trek to the East, and despite the absence of any background specialist knowledge of the region, or any ability to speak its languages. So I hope that those who are here who have such knowledge will forgive my lapses and will seek to remedy them, preferably not too abusively at the end of the lecture. But when I was invited to give these lectures, I knew that I simply had to try and take advantage of this opportunity in order to think through the significance of what's going on in Eastern Central Europe and the former Soviet Union, henceforth Eastern Europe, for the sake of brevity. And I'm very grateful to both BP and to LSE for having given me this opportunity. Now, having been unable to resist the temptation to stray beyond my usual terrain of international economics, I naturally felt I had to look for some way to link it to my area of expertise. And it occurred to me that it might be interesting to try and trace the way in which developments on the world scale over the last couple of decades have influenced the emergence of a quite unusual degree of professional consensus, which seems to exist at the moment, on what needs to be done in order to make this transition. So that was why I added the phrase, a global perspective, to the title of these lectures. In the second of them, I shall go on to ask whether the results so far suggest that this consensus is merited. But in the first one, I want to try and sketch how I see the consensus having come about. First of all, why was it even necessary to seek a transition? I think that's clearly because socialism had failed to provide an effective alternative way of organizing an economy. Now, that failure was certainly not always obvious. When I started learning economics at LSE in the 1950s, it wasn't obvious. At that time, the growth performance of Eastern Europe was superior to that of Western Europe. And even after when some statistician finally gets around to adjusting the figures for the built-in exaggeration that there was in the growth figures in the East, I think that will still remain a fact. And of course, a year or two later, Khrushchev was threatening to bury us because of that superior growth performance. Moreover, income was distributed more equally in the East than it was in the West, and that's something that remained true right to the end of communism, despite the privileges of the nomenklatura. If one opposed communism, it was because of Stalin's abuses of human rights, rather than because it was an obvious economic failure. Yet by the 1970s, it was becoming clear that the communist countries were falling behind, and by the 1980s, it was glaringly apparent. You had to compare Austria versus Hungary, East versus West Germany, North versus South Korea, or mainland China versus Taiwan. There was simply no reasonable explanation of those contrasts other than the fact that one system worked and the other didn't. Then why didn't central planning work? Well, think back to the initial debate on the feasibility of central planning by economists in the 1920s, and there were really two obstacles to the successful identification of a successful operation of a socialist economy that were identified in that debate. One of those reasons was already a very old one in discussion. It was the problem of inadequate motivation of economic actors. The other one was novel. It was originally formulated, I think, in a paper of Ludwig von Mises in 1920, and that related to what it was argued would be the prohibitive information requirements needed to permit efficient central planning when one dispensed with a price system. Now, to my mind, if that second, more technocratic problem were the only one, then Oskar Lange's market socialism, which essentially said it would be possible to simulate a price system, would have provided an answer. But in fact, the attempts of the reform economists to move in that direction never seemed to achieve very much. And I think too much emphasis on the inadequacy of information as the reason for the downfall of the communist system also faces the problem of explaining why, for a time, the communist economies did work tolerably well, indeed really rather well, back in the early post-war period. Of course, one can argue that a system without information mediated via market clearing prices became progressively less adequate as the economy became more complex. But nevertheless, while I think the information difficulty was a real one, it seems to me to be less fundamental than the old ideological issue of motivation, which after all relates to one of the two basic emotional appeals of socialism, the other one being the appeal to a sense of class injustice. The promise of socialism was to appeal to replace this base appeal to pecuniary self-interest as the principal motivation for economic action by something more noble like altruism. Now, I'm not an uncritical adherent of public choice theory, which I think makes the demeaning assumption that everyone in public life is there only for what they can get out of it, and totally uninterested in promoting the public good. But I have to say that that extreme assumption is surely less far-fetched than the opposite extreme assumption that everyone will always be prepared to work altruistically to promote the public good, or what they're told is the public good, with no prospect of personal reward. I think there are few of us who would be prepared to act month after month like socialist heroes were supposed to, especially after the word gets out that the elite is engaged in rent-seeking. And so one got in the socialist world the attempts to work as little as possible and the fights over norms, and even more devastatingly, perhaps, the lack of motivation to care for or to economize on the use of capital and natural resources. As George Soros has put it, capital had no guardian. Another area that seems to have suffered unduly was the incentive to innovate. And even the neglect of the environment, which was the most paradoxical failure of socialism to those of us who were brought up on Beaumont's vision of the state as the guardian of externalities, seems to have been a breakdown, a result of the breakdown of the professional ethic, which I think of as a willingness to follow practices that are aimed at benefiting a client, even if there is no close reward of outcome, personal outcome to success. But that was stretched, that professional ethic was stretched beyond breaking point when personal reward was so divorced from achievement. Essentially, it seems to me the record suggests that greed can be contained by competition in socially benign way, to work in socially benign ways, far more easily than it can be displaced, which was the original socialist aim. Now, that diagnosis of inadequate motivation is consistent with the historical record of progressive decay from the early period of heroic accomplishments of the socialist system through the black period of Stalin, when fear provided an all too common motivation, to the pervasive cynicism that had led to stagnation by the 1970s. And the outlook was for worse to come. The extraction of energy and materials was encountering diminishing returns, while the inputs of energy and materials per unit of GDP was actually rising rather than declining through the 1980s. So sooner or later, I think someone had to come to power who was conscious of the yawning and widening gulf between life under socialism and that in the market economies, and who'd try and do something about it. And of course, the major event of that type was when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union with no big brother breathing down his neck. Now, his program of perestroika was intended to address the problem of missing motivation. Enterprises were no longer required to transfer all of their profits to the state at the end of the year, which used to be affected by the expedient of cancelling bank balances, but instead, which obviously was damaging to motivation to anybody who worked in an enterprise. Instead, there was a profits tax, and enterprises were allowed to retain profits over and above that and use them either on paying additional wages or managerial incentives or additional investments that they could decide for themselves. In addition, many enterprises were given the right to export rather than having to go through a foreign trade organization, and then allowed to keep a portion of their hard currency earnings, again with the intention of providing an incentive to develop exports. However, the attempt to build some incentives into the system, into the economy, turned out to do more harm than good. A first problem was that the loss of tax revenue through the effective lowering of corporate tax rates wasn't compensated by increased tax revenue from any other source or by decreased expenditures. On the contrary, expenditures were increased in the original drive to increase investment and thereby stimulate growth, and other tax revenues were cut through the anti-alcohol campaign. And so one had the Soviet Union going in a couple of years from being a paragon of fiscal virtue to an economy where there was a budget deficit of almost 10% of GNP. The ubiquitous price controls ensured that the resulting inflation was repressed and a monetary overhang built up instead of price increases, but that made the inflation more rather than less damaging as goods progressively disappeared from the shelves. And I think we can say that the the simple failure of macroeconomic prudence is the major explanation for the catastrophic breakdown of the old Soviet economy. I think there was also a microeconomic factor that underlay the Soviet collapse, and that goes right back to a paper that emerged from the school when I was a student here in the 1950s, the paper by Lipsy and Lancaster on the general theory of the second best. I can remember us being very mystified when we came across it in our final year as to whether second best theory was all about pathological cases that didn't have any practical relevance, or whether it destroyed the scientific basis for all reform proposals, given that in fact it's inconceivable that all but one of the conditions for Pareto optimality will be satisfied simultaneously, or whether it contained important implications that ought to be taken account of in policy design. Well, perhaps the rest of the profession decided years ago which of those three was true, but I think I've only decided which I'm convinced of since looking at what's been going on in Eastern Europe. I think that the third interpretation is the correct one. There are the fact that partial reform has repeatedly worsened rather than improved the situation, very much for second best reasons, and therefore reformers need to take care to design programs that are immune to sabotage by the second best. Now, there are lots of anecdotes about to illustrate how partial reforms can lead to worse outcomes, but I'm going to tell you my favorite one, even though it did appear in The Economist 2 weeks ago, and that is Jeffrey Sachs's story about how Poland had emerged as an exporter of semi-tropical flowers by 1989. Now, Poland's climatic endowment does not make it an obvious candidate to export semi-tropical flowers, and no central planner would ever have dreamt of doing anything so idiotic as subtracting value by having an enterprise. On the other hand, you had enterprises that were trying to maximize their self-interest and were now told they could do so, and that were facing energy prices of 10% or less at the world level, and exporting semi-tropical flowers became a very attractive thing to do. And so they did it and impoverished Poland in the process. Now, I think that there's going to be an opportunity for a wonderful thesis somewhere for somebody to compile a list of these anecdotes and put them in some sort of analytic shape with a view to giving us a sense of just how widespread these problems really were. But as far as I know, nobody has done any work so far, so I'm simply going to have to assert that there are lots of other anecdotes like that, and semi-tropical flowers weren't an isolated case. If you tell agents to pursue their self-interest without a set of prices that reflect relative scarcities, then you're inviting economic decline. And socialist prices weren't intended to reflect relative scarcities. Allocative decisions were made by the planners. The function of prices was essentially to influence the distribution of income. And so the prices simply weren't intended to do that, and when they started doing it because of partial decentralization, one had disaster. So I'm arguing that central planning failed because it lacked a mechanism to motivate agents to make routine decisions in socially beneficial ways, and especially to make innovation and economy and the use of capital a part of the routine way of doing things. In some cases, the attempts to provide the missing motivation made things worse rather than better, most conspicuously where they were allowed to undermine macroeconomic discipline, but also, more insidiously, by giving rise to pervasive second-best problems. Now, what would those conclusions suggest for somebody who wanted to give the citizens of those countries a chance to catch up with living standards in the West? In other words, for an East European reform economist or one of their Western advisors. I think the obvious implication concerns the breadth of the needed reform program. The economy must be transformed to a market economy. Half measures won't do. That's the obvious implication. That's not to prejudge the choice between having the laissez-faire version of a market economy to which Anglo-Saxons tend to subscribe, at least in principle, versus the social market economy as described, for example, by Hans Tietmeyer in his presentation here last week, versus the Japanese variant, where the corporation regards itself as responsible to a series of stakeholders rather than just to shareholders. But I think what it does rule out is the sort of massive public sector that was sought by socialist parties in the West in the early post-war years, or the state-directed economies that were built by many third world countries in the 1960s and 1970s. Balcerowicz in Poland, Václav Klaus in Czechoslovakia, and ultimately the Russian reform economists as well, rejected the search for a third way between communism and capitalism. As usual, Klaus expressed it particularly forcefully. Tietmeyer mentioned this in his lecture last week, when he quipped that the third way is the quickest way to the third world. Now, as it happens, the third world had already been coming to that same conclusion in the 1980s. I first realized that close to the end of the decade, and we at the Institute for International Economics organized a conference which was designed to explore the nature and extent of the change in attitudes that was occurring in Latin America. The conference was based on a paper of mine which was called What Washington Means by Policy Reform, and it presented simply a taxonomy of the policy reforms that were being commended to Latin America by mainstream opinion in Washington, by which I mean basically the U.S. government, the economists in the U.S. government, and the international financial institutions. The 10 headings of this taxonomy were fiscal discipline, reorientation of public expenditure towards things like health and education, and away from defense, administration, indiscriminate subsidies, white elephants. The third heading was tax reform. The fourth one was financial liberalization. The fifth one was a single competitive exchange rate for current account transactions. Then trade liberalization, liberalization of foreign direct investment, privatization, deregulation, and the establishment of secure property rights in the informal sector. If you want to give a quick summary of that list, you can say it consisted of macroeconomic discipline, microeconomic liberalization, and outward orientation. Now, I labeled this list, I think rather unwisely, the Washington Consensus. I have to confess it didn't occur to me at the time that to use this term to describe a list of the policy reforms that were being urged on Latin America might be interpreted by my Latin friends as implying that Washington had figured out what needed to be done and was then engaged in imposing economic correctness upon them. But while Latin America has subscribed enthusiastically to this sort of program over the period, there's still a lingering resentment about the name that I gave to it. Now, in fact, my view is that Washington had come to those views as part of a worldwide intellectual trend in which Latin America itself had contributed, primarily through the work of Hernando de Soto on property rights for the informal sector, and which has had its most dramatic manifestation in Eastern Europe. But since that explanation doesn't seem to have assuaged my critics, I want to endorse in substance their latest barb, which is that the term is a misnomer because the Washington Consensus is now being implemented in every capital of the Western Hemisphere except Washington. They seem to have forgotten Havana, but nevertheless, in substance, I think that what they say is right, and I fear that things may get even worse following last week's primary election in New Hampshire, which may push Washington even further along the populist path that it, of course, condemns when it's practiced anywhere else in the world. The substance of the reforms being sought in Eastern Europe overlaps rather strikingly with those that have been taken up in one Latin country after another for the past 7 years. And those aren't the only parts of the world where macroeconomic discipline, microeconomic liberalism, and outward orientation have acquired a new respectability. Here in Britain, Mrs. Thatcher was associated with at least the first two of those causes. Never felt she was terribly outward oriented, but certainly macroeconomic discipline and microeconomic liberalism were dear to her heart, and those have now been endorsed across the political spectrum. And the same thing is true in Southern Europe, East Asia, Australia and New Zealand, Last year, India, even spottily in sub-Saharan Africa, one has seen the same revolution in economic attitudes. And basically, I think the mainstream economics, which we were taught here at LSE in the 1950s, and I think, quite honestly, a lot of us were a little bit suspicious of it in our political hearts, and nowadays it's triumphed. It's broadly accepted. Now, in my view, that triumph results once again from a set of stylized facts that simply became too apparent to ignore any longer. The crucial fact is that the most successful cases of development occurred in resource-poor economies, which chose capitalism, macroeconomic prudence, and outward orientation, rather than the resource-rich economies that used the rents from resource exploitation plus deficit spending in order to build large state sectors and invest in import-substituting industries. And the professional literature, think of the sort of work of Balassa, has tended to support the obvious inference that, at least in a broad sense, the policies produced the results. I think there still remains some doubt about exactly what the magic in the policies was. One really can't invoke Kabir in order to justify the minimalist state and laissez-faire, so there is still some room for debate there, but in broad terms, it's just too clear to deny. I want to add two further points. One is that macro-discipline, micro-liberalization, and outward orientation are intended to supplement rather than displace the traditional emphasis in the development literature on savings and investment, and especially investment in human capital. I think that's common ground and hasn't changed in the last decade. The other is that the new orthodoxy crystallized in the Washington Consensus has received further confirmation in the eyes of many of us by the recovery that is now clearly gathering force in Latin America. It took up to 5 years for those policies to produce a turnaround, a recovery from the debt crisis, before they began to pay off, but clearly they are now doing so. One can see now that adjustment is an investment and not an exercise in self-flagellation. Now, while the reform programs and the economies in transition are clearly pursuing those same three objectives, the task is altogether more demanding than anything confronted elsewhere in the world. And the first reason is the need to create the institutions of a market economy from the ground up. When the Berlin Wall fell, there were few of us who'd ever given any thought as to how one would go about organizing a transition to a market economy, because it never occurred to us that this would be a question that would arise in our lifetime. The exciting thing about being a part of the great trek to the East is that one is repeatedly challenged to think a little bit about the logic of the institutions that underlie the market economy, which we'd always taken for granted. For example, what legal infrastructure is needed to support the development of markets? What arrangements for corporate governance result in enterprises acting in the social interest? Can commercial banks fulfill their principal social function if they lack employees trained in the art of loan appraisal? And so on and so forth. I think it's clear that if the subject of economics gains a new dimension out of the events in Eastern Europe, it will be by a new understanding of the institutional bases of a market economy. Perhaps we shall even get some insights into that debate that never seems to quite happen about the relative merits of the alternative forms of market economy that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Anglo-Saxon profit maximization versus the social market economy versus the Japanese tradition. But then, in the second place, the challenge facing Eastern Europe is a whole lot broader than simply making the transition to a market economy. Every one of those countries is also attempting to replace the authoritarian regime of the past by a democratic system. There seems to be a general assumption these days that democracy and a market economy are natural complements. I have to say I hope that turns out to be right, but I can't help recalling that when I first went to Latin America 15 years ago, exactly the opposite was believed. A market economy was regarded as something which only the totalitarian military regimes in the Southern Cone would either want to impose on their populations or conceivably have any chance of imposing. So for the moment, I think that we should treat the natural complementarity of democracy and the market as a hypothesis, and for some of us at least a hope, but not as an established fact. Then there's a third dimension to the transition that's being sought, at least in the case of the Soviet Union, and that's decolonization, the dismantling of the last of the world's great multinational empires, which has released all sorts of long-suppressed nationalist tensions and leads to a whole extra range of economic problems stemming from the likelihood of monetary disintegration and the possibility of a breakdown in trade relations. I've already had an attempt to address that in a study that I did last year with Oleg Havrilishin, a Ukrainian-born economist. In these lectures, I simply note that this extra dimension makes the challenge facing the new nations of the CIS even more extraordinary than that faced by their neighbors to the immediate West, who in turn confront more dimensions than do reforming developing countries, let alone anything that we in the West have attempted in living memory. Let me return and focus on the economic aspects of the transition. I think there's never been much difficulty right from the start in identifying the long list of reforms that would have to be made in order to convert a planned economy to a market economy. Establishing property rights, abolishing the planning mechanism and state orders, and making enterprises autonomous units, privatizing those enterprises, imposing hard budget constraints on them, allowing them to fire workers, liberalizing prices, breaking up monopolistic enterprises and introducing anti-monopoly legislation, establishing a competitive commercial banking system and recapitalizing the banks, making the central bank responsible for controlling inflation, creating a social safety net, eliminating the monetary overhang, reforming the tax system, securing fiscal discipline, permitting inward foreign direct investment, establishing convertibility for current account transactions at a single competitive exchange rate, and liberalizing trade. That's sort of a fairly standard list. Obviously, the exact list varies depending on the tastes of the particular speaker, but that's pretty standard. What is controversial is not what needs to be done, but the question of sequencing, or in particular, the merits or otherwise of having a big bang in the process. I think the widespread adoption of big bangs in Eastern Europe is a remarkable break from the post-war pattern. Until the Polish program at the beginning of 1990, I think there's only been one other program that one could reasonably have called a big bang between the Erhard program of 1948 in West Germany, again which Tietmeyer talked about, and that Polish program. There was only one in that interim period. Even when Indonesia had to stabilize a near hyperinflation in 1968, the approach was a gradualist one. And similar recommendations for trying to ease hyperinflation down over several years were being given to Bolivia in 1985. Now, credit for the rejection of that advice in favor of an attempt to stop inflation in its tracks, I think, should go at least in part to Jeffrey Sachs. Now, Jeffrey was advising at that time the opposition candidate, the one who did not win the Bolivian election. But when he went back, having lost, he did leave behind some calculations of the extent of the fiscal contraction that would be required, and the idea that really it didn't make sense to try and stabilize a hyperinflation gradually over 3 or 4 years. But there's one bit of intellectual history that I think is worth putting on the record, and that is that Sachs was not responsible for the Bolivian decision to go for a big bang in the sense of a program that would combine, in a single decree as it happens, stabilization, liberalization, and opening up the economy to the outside world. That was a decision of the Bolivian team, which was taken during the period immediately after the election of Paz Estenssoro, when Sachs wasn't advising the Bolivian government, nor present in Bolivia. And he came back as an advisor a little while later, and he approved very strongly of their courageous approach. And I think where he fits into the picture is as the transmission mechanism that brought the idea of a big bang to Eastern Europe, that he played a key role in mustering support for a big bang in Poland in the second half of 1989. Now, who knows, maybe people would have had the idea anyway, even without Jeffrey Sachs or without the Bolivian president. I think it's an interesting reflection on our times that half a dozen policymakers in a poverty-stricken country high in the Andes should have provided the model for the programs that are attempting to terminate the biggest failed social experiment in history. Rather to my surprise, I found that I endorsed both the Bolivian decision to go for a big bang and also arguing the need for much the same thing in Eastern Europe. I find that surprising because I've always regarded myself as an instinctive gradualist. I took it for granted that the gradual liberalization of the British and European economies in the post-war years was the natural way to go about it and laid the basis for the boom of the 1960s. I've certainly argued and still do argue for trade liberalization to be done gradually on the ground that there is a limit to the rate at which resources can be redeployed into new export industries, and that until such redeployment is possible, it's better to have the resources being used producing something, even if it's of low value added, than having them thrown into disuse and adding zero value. I also criticized the liberalization program in the southern cone of South America a decade ago as precipitate. In particular, I was very critical of the decision to liberalize the capital account of the balance of payments so soon. I'm not quite sure whether I understood why it was a bad thing at the time, but since then there's been a big literature on it, and now I think I know, and there are really three objections. One is that you need to liberalize trade first, because otherwise capital may flow into the long industries and give you immiserizing growth. The second objection is that you need to have a non-traditional export sector already well established to eliminate the danger that a capital inflow may lead to such an appreciation which will devastate the export sector and kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And the third is that you need to have a liberalized domestic financial system in order to distribute a capital inflow to activities with high rates of return. So once again, I was certainly a gradualist on that issue. So a year or so ago, this preference for gradualism led me to ask the question, suppose you want to do as little as possible simultaneously in the interest of minimizing administrative overload and economic disruption, how little can you get away with? What's the minimum number of things that can be done at the same time? Or what's the content not of a big bang, but of a minimum bang? So specifically, let's ask what has to be done at the time that prices are liberalized. That seems a fairly crucial event to focus on. And then first, of course, one asks, well, do all prices have to be liberalized simultaneously? And I have to say that I've failed to identify any appealing principle that could guide the order in which prices are gradually liberalized, an order which would minimize second-best problems. The sort of obvious principle, the one that was applied in Russia last month, was to retain controls on socially necessary goods like bread and milk, and free luxuries first and necessities last. That's sort of common advice. But of course, if producers have any opportunity to vary the output mix in response to price incentives, that leads to perverse results. Producers have an incentive to divert output towards luxuries, and the shortages of necessities become even more chronic than before. Now, in principle, you could counter that by subsidizing the production of necessities if the budget can stand the strain. But we generally teach that it would be more efficient to free prices and subsidize needy consumers. So, and in any event, one has to ask, it seems that such subsidies don't always work, and we have a very graphic illustration in Russia this past month. In Russia, liquid milk was a socially necessary good on which price controls were maintained, while butter and cheese were socially less necessary, and therefore their prices were liberated. So, hey presto, what has happened? Production has been diverted into the production of butter and cheese, and it is even more difficult to get milk than it was before. And that's a typical example of what happens in that sequence. Now, I just don't know of any other plan for gradual price decontrol that begins to make sense, and so I think one is driven back to the conclusion that prices should be liberalized simultaneously. And that in itself is enough to guarantee a pretty big bang, even if a few prices, typically utilities, rents, and energy, are initially exempted from decontrol. So, okay, that's the first thing. We have a big price liberalization looks sensible. Second, could macroeconomic stabilization precede price liberalization? Well, sometimes I think that would be possible. Where consumer subsidies aren't enormous, that may be. It may be possible to establish fiscal discipline, which is, of course, the sine qua non of macroeconomic stabilization, before prices are liberalized. But in a number of the East European economies, subsidies had become such a large source of spending that it had become almost inconceivable that budget bounds could be restored without the price liberalization needed to dispense with the subsidies. And in those cases, I think it was impractical to stabilize before freeing prices. Okay, then, how about postponing stabilization to a later stage, until after prices have been liberalized? Well, it's difficult enough for an established market economy to function tolerably under conditions of high inflation. But I think to ask enterprises that are first being told that they should make decisions with reference to prices instead of accepting orders from the planners, and have prices that don't mean anything because they're changing all the time and you have no sense of what the equilibrium price is, to ask them to work with reference to such prices and a chronic inflation is just creating an impossible situation. Moreover, one can look back to the Bhagwati-Kruger study on trade liberalization, which was the first of the large cross-country comparative studies, and which established back in the 1970s that attempts to open up an economy to the outside world were time and again thwarted if there was an absence of macroeconomic stabilization. And since then, the World Bank has had a series of structural adjustment programs, has studied the success of those, and again, it has it affirms emphatically that stabilization should not be delayed until after liberalization. It's true one can cite odd instances of countries that started to liberalize before stabilizing, like Mexico, or that undertook a major liberalization following a half-baked stabilization, like Turkey, but the professional consensus is that stabilization needs to come at the beginning of a reform program. So, once again, therefore, unless one happens to be in the situation where stabilization is feasible earlier, one has to look to simultaneity. Now, stabilization requires not only fiscal discipline, so as to limit future monetary emission, but it also requires that any monetary overhang inherited from the past during a period of repressed inflation should be eliminated. And indeed, if that isn't done deliberately, either by a monetary reform or by the sale of public sector assets, it will occur automatically at the time of price liberalization by a corrective inflation. And then finally, stabilization requires that monetary emission be stringently controlled, which implies not just fiscal discipline, but also the hardening of enterprise budget constraints. Now, that provides one of several reasons why enterprise autonomy also should be a part of the minimum bang. We've already discussed the second best problems that arise if enterprises are allowed to act autonomously prior to prices being freed to reflect relative scarcities. And conversely, once prices are freed, one wants enterprises to be able to respond to price signals. And moreover, once prices reflect scarcity, one wants to exploit the incentive effects of the hard budget constraints. So I conclude that enterprises should be made autonomous and planning abolished at the same time that prices are freed. Now, enterprise autonomy is only a first step on the road to privatization. It may be possible to make a start with small privatization prior to price liberalization, and one can agree with the critics of the Russian program that it would have been desirable to have privatized much of the supply and distribution network prior to price liberalization. But nevertheless, I think it's very clear that it would be wrong to go very far in privatization prior to price liberalization. That's for a fundamental reason, that if the prices are not signaling which enterprises should be driven out of existence, one does not want to privatize enterprises and run the risk of closing them down because they are being subjected to price controls which may be imposing sub-equilibrium output prices on them. So once again, I think one concludes that there should not, you can't do very much in the way of privatization prior to a big bang. I think, on the other hand, that a lot of privatization is going to take much longer. If you're going to do privatization right, then it has to take a lot longer. You have to define property rights properly, you have to get an effective structure of corporate governance, and you have to make sure the state gets a reasonable price for the assets, and all those things take time. So I'm not suggesting that you put a lot of privatization into the minimum bang. An implication of enterprise autonomy is that the enterprises should be free to fire workers who contribute less to the value of output than they cost the firm to employ. Indeed, one could hardly contemplate imposing a hard budget constraint until enterprises have that right. But it's politically impossible, or at least if it isn't, it ought to be, to contemplate allowing workers to be fired without providing some form of social safety net for them independent of the enterprise, which is what used to provide the social security. So once again, the social safety net has to be put in place no later than enterprises are made autonomous. Then I think the final point is that allowing autonomous enterprises to charge whatever prices they see fit runs a severe danger of getting massive price increases in an economy where the planners had deliberately built up monopoly sources of supply on the theory that economies of scale are unlimited and that competition is wasteful, and they were betted in doing that by the systematic underpricing of transport. In the long run, one may want to break up those enterprises into competing firms, but that again takes time. One can try and eliminate entry restrictions quickly, but you can't rely on much of a rapid build-up of competition from new entrants, so there's really only one source from which one can look to get any discipline on enterprises that are allowed to fix their prices in the short run, and that is from foreign competition. That's the heart of the case for moving very quickly to current account convertibility and relatively liberal trade. And this is an enormous change from how, for example, Western Europe liberalized in the post-war period, when we took years to go to current account convertibility. De facto, it took about 10 years to 1955, and de jure, it took 13. Well, it was semi-de jure in 1958, real de jure was only 1961. So we took a very long time about it, and yet here we go advising the East Europeans that they should introduce counter-account convertibility far quicker. What's the reason for the difference? I think there is a very good reason for the difference, that Western Europe had a functioning market economy. It had a price system in which the prices meant something. They may not have been perfect, but they did, broadly speaking, reflect relative scarcity. And hence, convertibility was a bit of a luxury which allowed the country to take best advantage of its relations with the rest of the world. Whereas, in contrast, in Eastern Europe, it is playing a far more fundamental role. This is the only way in which they can hope to get any competitive discipline and a sensible price system in the short run, is if they import them from the world economy, and that requires current account convertibility, meaning the right of any importer who wishes to buy goods or services abroad to have access to foreign exchange in order to purchase those imports. So I concluded that a minimum bang needed to include widespread price liberalization, accompanied by the establishment of enterprise autonomy and current account convertibility, and, unless they'd already been accomplished, by macroeconomic stabilization and the creation of a social safety net. Now, obviously, such a package can't be introduced overnight. It seems needs a certain amount of time to be designed and legislated. That time has varied from a year in Czechoslovakia, which did this transformation by far the most neatly of any of the countries, to under 2 months in Russia, where everything is the most chaotic. But the point is that once preparations have been made, the argument is that one should make a decisive, broad-based move from one set of rules to another. So despite my being a temperamental gradualist, I came to the conclusion that the specific circumstances of the economies in transition demanded a minimum bang, which in practice isn't really very different to the Big Bang advocated by Jeffrey Sachs, who's a temperamental advocate of shock treatment. It's a remarkable fact that a rather similar prescription is accepted among, I think, most mainstream economists. Obviously, the details of presentation vary, but I really can't identify any major substantive difference between, say, the advice in the IMF, World Bank, OECD, EBRD study on the Soviet economy, the EC Commission's report on the Soviet Union, the EASA report, the wider study, the advice dispensed by Anders Asland, Rudy Dornbusch, Stan Fisher, Richard Layard, Jeffrey Sachs, Larry Summers, or even my little minimum bang. For once, the profession seemed to have reached timely agreement on some novel and pretty fundamental issues of momentous import. However, we now have over 2 years of experience with reform programs that more or less follow these recommendations, and the outcome so far is not obviously reassuring. Perhaps it was inevitable that the initial euphoria would give way to gloom, but one can hardly reproach the citizens of Eastern Europe for having a certain gloom at this stage of the process. So tomorrow I'm going to talk about the reasons for the current pessimism, try and inquire into the causes of the disappointments, ask whether there is reason to revise the advice that we've been offering, and discuss whether the West should do more to try and ensure that the transition is successfully completed. Well, you anticipate something that I was going to say tomorrow. I agree with you that in China, at least, I think one has to ask whether the same thing could have been done in the East European economies, or whether the Chinese case was dependent upon the existence of a large and relatively self-sufficient agrarian sector. But certainly I agree that China is a successful example of gradualism. And that's indeed one of the points that I plan to raise tomorrow and will now make more briefly. I think that there's an excellent case for having a preferential trade area, but I wouldn't expect too much from it. It seems to me that for the Central European countries, or maybe all of the economies in transition, to trade among themselves freely makes sense in a period even in which it will be rational for them to maintain relatively high protection against the rest of the world, precisely because, as you say, one risks having too many bankruptcies simultaneously at the beginning of the process if one goes straight to free trade vis-a-vis the rest of the world. But they all suffered from broadly similar distortions in the past, in particular an uneconomically low price of energy, and hence if they move to world prices immediately, they all expose their energy-intensive industries, in particular, to devastating competition from the West, and they clearly don't face that same sort of problem if they trade with one another. So I indeed regard that as quite a rational thing to do, but as I say, I wouldn't rely on that being an enormous boost. The competition is not going to be particularly effective. It's in this business one ideally wants some foreign competition which will be a price disciplining competition without being so devastating that it drives the firms out of business. One wants competition, but competition which they can meet. One wants to set them attainable obstacles, or at least the average firm. One should always be aiming to have a certain margin of firms, the most inefficient ones, being first out of business. But I really don't think it makes sense to be imposing bankruptcy on a whole number of firms at the same time, quicker than it's possible to redeploy resources elsewhere. No, not really. I guess I have a much more low-profile attitude to foreign direct investment than either most people, either pro or con. You tend to get two attitudes. Some people think that foreign direct investment is the salvation of everything and should be encouraged and even perhaps subsidized. And other people think regard it with great suspicion and want to control it. I basically want to free it, but not to subsidize it. Let it in on the same basis as everybody else, and then you'll get the particular industries which are going to be beneficial to you. But 49% holding will exclude some companies that otherwise would come in, and I don't see in general that I would want to see a very specific justification for that, and I don't know of any such justification in the case of insurance. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's exactly what I would expect. I had some very convincing reason as to why foreign investment was going to be bad in that particular industry. I would not want to impose such a restriction. Well, Well, I don't know that I would worry terribly about that, as long as you're really drawing from the world so that they are going to be competing among one another. That's the main thing that I would look for. After all, the British motor industry is entirely composed of foreign firms, and it's doing much better than when it used to be composed of British firms, isn't it? The way in which I would want to go gradually in that particular context is by retaining relatively high transitional tariffs, by initially liberalizing all the quantitative restrictions. I mean, I see no argument for quantitative restrictions, apart from when you get onto guns and drugs and that sort of thing. But any legitimate goods, one simply gets rid of the quantitative restrictions. But transitional tariffs, no, I think there is a serious case for maybe starting off with those relatively high, and that can do the same job. I don't recommend transitional tariffs as high as the Japanese tariffs that are being demanded if they liberalize price rice imports in the Uruguay round. You may know they want 700% tariffs on rice in that case. That strikes me as a bit high. But I'm prepared to have initially fairly high tariffs in some cases if that is the price of going with... And this is somewhere where I think that there would be fairly substantial disagreements among the people whom I said qualitatively we all think the same. But when we come to this particular issue, I think you'd find some fair disagreements. There's no sign of an increase in supplies to the consumer at this stage, I'm afraid. And I wouldn't expect... I think the best you can hope for from the Russian liberalization at this stage is that it will ration the existing supplies in a more efficient way. Instead of people having to spend half their day standing in queues, now they hopefully only have to stand in queues for socially necessary goods. And other things they can actually go and... buy them relatively freely. I think that's really the... I don't see much chance that the enterprises are going to be responding on the supply side until you get to the next stage, which indeed means privatization of the supply and distribution network. That clearly should be the priority. And people talk about all sorts of things for enabling a privatized distribution network to get off the ground quickly, like privatizing army trucks, just selling off the army trucks to anybody who wants to set up in haulage. And those are the sorts of things that need to be done. Now, I don't know about the army trucks, but most of these things tend to be the responsibility of local levels of government. And many of those local authorities are still in the control of old-fashioned communists, maybe with a different name, but nevertheless, it's still basically the same guys. And so... the chances of the Russians getting anywhere near achieving their objective of, I think it's 60 or maybe 70% privatization of small enterprises this year, I would have thought was very poor indeed. But that's what one has to look for. But even that is going to take, but we're talking about months or several years rather than something that can happen overnight. Incidentally, it is not true that prices have been liberalized in the former Soviet Union. They've been liberalized in Russia. and I guess two of the Baltics, and that's about it. Maybe Armenia.
John, I'd like your view on a point raised in a paper written for the World Bank, leading to the rather unpalatable conclusion that privatization has to go in the World Bank. Namely, that if enterprises were given commercial freedom but had not become privately owned, they would maximize the wrong thing, namely the present worth during the remainder of their working life of the labor force, leading to enormous capital.
There's a real danger of that, there's no question, but since it isn't practical to privatize everything quickly, one has to try and think of some ways of getting some discipline in the system. And the usual suggestion is that one should corporatize, that's to say, turn them into joint stock companies with 75% of the shares being owned by the state and the other 25% by the workers and the managers. Now, the argument is that as long as that's a real ownership holding, as opposed to a claim to 25% of the profits with no ability to sell out on the market, that gets the incentives much better. That then says to the workers that they have an interest in that enterprise staying viable and having a higher value when it's privatized so that they acquire some worthwhile assets in the same way that one got good incentive effects out of the free distribution of shares in Britain under Mrs. Thatcher's privatizations. And that's certainly an argument that I go along with, and that is what the Russians are planning.
I think there's one thing to ask.
nevertheless, Czechoslovakia still has had feedback.
You anticipate once again something I was planning to say tomorrow. I think it's absolutely right that there was a choice in Czechoslovakia and there wasn't a choice in Poland. And as a matter of fact, I would still support what Czechoslovakia did in terms of the microeconomic changes, the introduction of the micro changes. I do think they made some mistakes in their macro policy, and they had a budget surplus of 8% of GNP, largely because the enterprises were expected to pay corporation taxes, which are high, on the inventory profits that came about as a result of the jump in the price level. So they had a very restrictive fiscal policy. They had great credit stringency as a result of the devaluation, pushing up the price level, leading to this price jump. And they had real interest rates of 20%. And you have that combination, and you get deflation. And that is what I think the Czechoslovaks made a big mistake in doing. I think the execution of the other part was a model, and then they spoilt it by doing crazy Thatcher-style macroeconomics.